Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots. I'm Lara Prendergast and I'm joined by Fraser Nelson and James Forsyth. So James, you've just returned from PMQs. Who came out on top, Corbyn or May?
Definitely Jeremy Corbyn. He asked short, pithy questions. He exposed the fact that there is this deep divide in the government over when to publish the Brexit white paper. David Davis, the Brexit secretary, would very much like it out before the June EU Council, arguing that that would show the EU what we want. Theresa May wants to hold it back. One of the reasons I think she wants to hold it back is she wants to kind of concentrate her diplomatic capital on trying to get the EU to agree to this kind of UK-wide version of the backstop, which is meant to solve the Northern Irish border. But that is causing huge controversy. My phone is now about to start buzzing on this very topic at the moment, because lots of people on the Brexiteer side of the Tory party say, hang on a second, if you agree to this backstop, where the UK stays in a customs union with the EU and continues to follow all EU rules on goods and agriculture until this big EU-UK trade deal is done, what incentive does the EU have to ever really talk trade with the UK? Because a deal would be done on goods and agriculture, where the EU sells a lot more to the UK than the UK sells to the EU. And what would, all that would be left to discuss would be services, where the UK has this £92 billion surplus with the rest of the EU. And so the worry is that this backstop becomes kind of permanent Brexit limbo for the UK.
And Fraser, we seem to be hearing a bit more about Labour's position on Brexit. What have you made of it so far?
It seems it's Super Tuesday next week, where we're going to get several votes in the House of Commons about Brexit legislation, has actually been made less dangerous, rather than more dangerous, by the Labour Party's decision not to propose to, not first of all to adopt the House of Lords amendments, to come up with one similar to theirs, and also not to go for single market membership during the transition, but to go for some kind of softer Brexit instead. Now, obviously, Jeremy Corbyn here has chosen not to go for the jugular for Theresa May, which is odd. I mean, quite often you wonder, what is Jeremy Corbyn's agenda here? I assume that his agenda, Brexit aside, Europe aside, is to cause maximum embarrassment for the government and to hasten the chances of it falling apart and there being a general election. But here, I think he seems to have placed party unity over the need to sock it to the Tories.
James, can you explain to us what Labour's amendment actually is?
So the first thing about it is, if you don't quite understand it, that's the point. The whole purpose of this amendment is not to be obviously comprehensible. Essentially, Labour feel that they can't back the amendment that came out of the House of Lords about staying in the European Economic Area, because that would involve a public admission that you are prepared to accept continuing free movement. And that is a red line issue for enough Labour MPs for Jeremy Corbyn not to want to go down that route. He knows if they do that, lots of Labour MPs in Leave voting seats will feel very uncomfortable and they feel that they can't back it. So instead, Labour have come up with this, what they call an internal market amendment. Now, it's quite a clever use of language, because what the EU calls the single market is the internal market. It is the EU internal market. And it basically says we want to keep everything the same, but it doesn't spell out any details on whether they would accept continuing free movement. And the fact that they won't accept the EEA amendment, they won't back that, where given the number of Tory rebels, they would actually have a chance of defeating the government if they could get all Labour MPs to vote for it, suggests to me that they're not prepared to go there yet on free movement. That is still a bridge too far, because it would be too obviously rejecting the result of the referendum. And I think it is very hard to credibly claim that if at the end of this process Britain stayed in the EEA and a customs union with the EU, that the referendum result had been respected, in inverted commas.
Well, of course, that all depends on what you think the referendum was about. You know, you can get some people who think it was about leaving the EEA. I would say that the absolutes in Brexit are that, first of all, we come out of the EU apparatus. Secondly, we end free movement. Other things like customs union and single market are less of a problem. Now, of course, single market contains free movement, which is why the Labour Party is saying, no, we need out of the single market. But the non-free movement parts of it, I think they're quite relaxed about. So it is possible to, you know, to have your Brexit softer while respecting what I would regard as the essentials of this. But everybody draws their own line here. And also in James's political column this week, he describes how the Brexiteers are divided, basically between those who are willing to stage a strategic retreat and be able to accept some more regulation, some more involvement with a view to negotiating themselves out at a later stage, and those who want to put steel in Theresa May's spine immediately.
James, how's it going down with the Europhile Labour MPs?
They're not happy because they say, look, for crying out loud, if we were prepared to get behind EEA, the number of Tory rebels means that we could defeat the government. And defeating the government is, A, obviously what oppositions want to do, but it also could keep Britain in the EEA. Also, the thing about the EEA is, as time runs short, the EEA is a completely off-the-shelf solution that you're reaching for. So there shouldn't be a problem in terms of negotiating it before March 2019 or even before October this year. So I think that's why they're unhappy. But I think the kind of question here is, Labour are taking kind of baby steps towards softer Brexit. Now the question is, you know, is Keir Starmer, who is clearly on the softer Brexit side, who is the Labour's Brexit spokesman, is he going to succeed ultimately in getting Jeremy Corbyn and John McDonnell over the line to single market membership and accepting all that entails by the end of this process? I'm personally slightly sceptical because I think Jeremy Corbyn will hide behind, oh, I can't do that to those Labour MPs in those seats which voted so heavily to leave, because Jeremy Corbyn doesn't really want to stay in the single market, because there is a view on the left that single market membership would stop them from pursuing some of the kind of socialist policies that they would like to pursue in power.
With some of the language they use, Labour says it wants to retain the benefits of a single market, but it wants complete access to the single market. Well, every country in the world has got access to the single market. I mean, Afghanistan can sell its goods onto the single market. So a lot of Labour's red lines are designed to sound verbally challenging, but being practically negligible.
And James, how much drama do you think there's going to be in the next few days over this?
Well, I think we're going to have two dramatic things going on simultaneously. One is going to be this question of whether the cabinet, the Brexit inner cabinet, can agree to a backstop to go to the EU, which I think is far from certain. I mean, there is real tension because David Davis and Boris Johnson basically take the view that if the UK proposes an untime-limited backstop, it will be stuck in this limbo land forever. So there's that drama, which is, can Theresa May get her cabinet to agree on a position? And then there's a drama of what happens on Tuesday when all these amendments come, and how many does the government win, and how many, which ones does the government lose, if any, and how much damage does that do to Theresa May? I thought today, watching PMQs, one thing I was very struck by was just how glum the Tory benches looked. This wasn't just the Brexiteers looking glum or the soft Brexit types looking glum. Everyone, it is in obvious listening to watching Jeremy Corbyn, who is not a genius at PMQs, watching how easily he pushes Theresa May onto the back foot on this, to see what a political hole the government is currently in on Brexit.
And James, reading your political column, which in the magazine has just been sent to press, you draw this divide between the hedgers and the ditchers, people who want to hedge it, and the last-to-ditch attempt to put Theresa May's courage to the sticking place. I get the impression from reading that, you didn't say it in the article, but you yourself are a ditcher.
I wouldn't say that. I think this is the irony, right? Both sides are right. You know, it's the problem with Brexit, but both the hedgers and the ditchers are right. The hedgers are right that ultimately all this courage requires you to be able to walk away from the negotiations. But the complete failure of the government to rigorously prepare for that means that's not a realistic option. The ditchers are right that handing over 39 billion quid, a lot of which is a goodwill payment. You know, no court would find that the UK owes True. As much money as that for very little in exchange is a bad deal. And it's unlikely that you're suddenly going to find that the EU is prepared to negotiate in a more accommodating fashion with you once you've committed to paying them the money, whatever happens. And I think the backstop is also deeply problematic. So, but this is the kind of problem with all Brexit analysis. It all starts from the kind of position of, well, you know, it's that old Irish joke when the chap asked him how he wants to get to Dublin. And he says, well, if you want to get to Dublin, I wouldn't start from here. And that is the problem with Brexit at the moment.
Talking of drama, James, have you been watching Love Island?
I have to admit, I still haven't succumbed.
Because there's this NHS doctor, who's one of the contestants, Dr. Alex George, and people are getting fairly angry about an NHS doctor appearing on a show like Love Island. Do you think it's right that he is?
I mean, I presume he's taken the time off work. It's not that he's told his bosses that he's sick. He's somehow on Love Island at the same time.
Eight weeks off, James.
I don't know, what is his legally contracted holiday?
Oh, it's a federal slug of holiday, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a decent slug of holiday.
Well, I mean, Kate Andrews argues on Coffee House today that he, you know, yes, he's an NHS doctor, but the public don't own him. Do you think that's fair?
Well, if he is allowed under his contract to take this time off, you know, his 8 weeks of holiday, yeah, he is, you know. At least he's not taking it off during the winter when winter crisis pressures, you know. I think we can see this. I don't know. I mean, is the presence of a doctor on this island needed or advisable? I mean, yeah.
But I think the controversy over it has actually highlighted a major problem with the way that doctors are trained and paid in this country. I mean, right now, you know, we limit the number of people who can train as doctors. They get subsidy during their training in return for relatively low wage afterwards. And as a result of it, that's where the idea comes from, that the public has paid so much to make you a doctor. So, you've got to accept, you know, relatively low salary when you're doing the job. And B, you'd better not go off to Australia, because if you're doing that, then you're taking all of our taxpayers' money with you.
But unlike the army, you know, in the army, basically, if the army pay for you to go for a university, or the military pay for you to go for university, and then you don't do your bit in of time, they reclaim the money back from you. But there is nothing to stop a doctor from being trained up at public expense through the whole system and then immediately flying off to go and work in, say, Australia, as Fraser said, and earn more money. I mean, this is one of the things that came out in the great junior doctors dispute, whether they should be required to do a certain number of years of work in the NHS in exchange for the public subsidy of their training.
Right, but I reckon they should get less public subsidy and be able to do what they want with their lives. They should be able to work where they want, can go in as many reality TV shows as they like. And also, we've got a global market for doctors and nurses now. If you look at the problems that Sajid Javid's having with his Tier 2 visas, that's because the NHS is crying out for more doctors who we are going to be taking from countries who probably could do with doctors there. But nations have lost control over doctors, not just Love Island, but the Philippines have lost control over their doctors and nurses. It's controversial, but it is now global. And I think we ought to really to have a system of training medics that reflects that and allows as many people as want to train to be doctors to do so, because it really is a wonderful ticket. My sister-in-law is a doctor, for example, and it's, you know, she's got incredible freedom to go and work in pretty much any country in Europe she wants. And it's a great ticket. And I think they should be able to use those tickets, even if it means taking their tops off so they can be plastered on websites like ours. Lara, I see the picture you chose for this doctor was more of a sort of Poldark character. He wasn't exactly with white clothes and a stethoscope.
I just thought our readers would appreciate
but he's
it.
Very, his chest is very different from Poldark's, is it not, though?
It's less hirsute. Thank you, James. Thank you, Fraser. And a reminder that this podcast is called Coffee House Shots. If you like it, please do let us know on iTunes. And we've got a special subscription offer. You can get 12 issues for just £12 if you go to spectator.co.uk/pod offer, and you'll get one of those lovely moleskin notebooks. Thanks for listening.